Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Our guest in this first part of Focus today is one of our regulars, that is, folks who show up here every month. David Sinnoh is his name. He's President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank and Trust. And monthly, we do a program with him on personal finance. The idea is that if you have some kind of question that deals with investing, financial planning, money management, call in, and I know Dave will do his best to help you out. The way we start these shows is he has a few prepared remarks that he will address on a particular topic, and then if you have questions on that or anything else that falls within this personal finance area, you're certainly welcome to call. Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, thank you, David, and good morning. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. You know, frankly, David, this morning my comments are actually going to be quoted directly from our chief investment officer, Paul Rudy, who wrote really what I think is an extraordinary article on the stock market. And he authored this really for our private newsletter. And I think it's worth repeating because it's very apropos and it really puts the markets, the volatility, into focus and perspective. Paul begins by saying that as J.P. Morgan observed many years ago, the only thing certain about the stock market is that it will fluctuate. And if it seems to you that the stock market has become more volatile, you are right. Now, Paul recently studied the daily returns of the NASDAQ index. Everybody's heard about that NASDAQ. And went back to 1984 and calculated the 100 days with the largest daily price swings. In other words, how volatile were things over the last several years. And after looking at all of that data, he discovered something very interesting. That the year 2000, of course, as we sort of perceived and sort of recognized, was a record year, accounting for 54 of the top 100 changes since 1984. That's how volatile things were in the NASDAQ last year. You'll remember an up day of 100 points, a down day of 200 points. Pretty volatile, where prices actually moved 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12% in any given day. And of course, based on just the first 3 months of 2001, this year is shaping up actually to be even more volatile than last year. Although most investors are aware of increased price volatility, I don't think that most are aware of the implications of this increase. Many traditional investors who once believed in diversification for the long term really recently resorted to non-diversified strategies after their friends chalked up 70 and 80% gains in high-tech stocks that seemed to be very high quality. And to many investors, it appeared that the rules of valuation had changed. In fact, the stocks were, well, they were just frankly overpriced. And even with the powerful bull market in stocks in the background, those who abandoned a diversified strategy and chose instead to buy and hold just a handful of stocks like, say, Cisco, Intel, Microsoft, Lucent, companies that we all knew, well, we know what happened. Those stocks haven't fared very well. And this failure of this strategy is another symptom of increased volatility. Of course, the past 12 months have made the simple buy and hold a few stock investment strategies really quite a perilous one. Investors now have learned that a price-to-earnings ratio of 75 or 100 is perhaps not acceptable, even if the company seems poised to deliver double-digit earnings returns. And to their surprise, of course, many investors who thought they could do fine for themselves without the advice of a seasoned advisor or professional are now no happier than a self-medicating patient, as Paul puts it, who has administered the wrong dose of the wrong drug. After a poor showing in 2000, of course, the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 indexes during the first quarter continued to show weakness. And it's really only the last few days since Alan Greenspan stepped in, reduced interest rates, suggesting more liquidity in the market, that things seem to be turning around just a bit. After declining 39%, last year, the NASDAQ, and the S&P declined 10% last year. In the first quarter this year, the NASDAQ lost another 26%, and the S&P actually fell about 12%. So the NASDAQ today is now about 40% below its level of 1 year ago. That's if you owned all 100 companies in the NASDAQ 100. If, unfortunately, you just picked and chose and you weren't very good at your pick and choosing, you might be down 60, 70, even 80% in many of those positions. And in fact, an investor who invested $100 in the NASDAQ composite on December of 1998, really December 31, felt pretty good after making 84% in 1999. But 2.5 years later, guess what? That original dollar investment is probably worth somewhere between 85 and 92 cents, depending upon when and where you got in. And of course, the Standard & Poor's Index declined as well, approximately 12% from its highs last year. It was quite a bit worse a week ago. We could have looked at a negative 25%, but as a result of the bull move over the last 3 or 4 days, as a result of Greenspan, a lot of that loss has been halved. While it is true that these two popular areas of the markets have really taken a pounding over the past 15 months, a globally diversified investor that stayed the course is not facing anywhere near this devastation. The majority of the asset classes that are out there, and in fact many of those that we use in our own client portfolios, have performed substantially better than the NASDAQ or the S&P 500. The bottom line, something we've preached for a long time, something I continue to preach, diversification works best when you need it most, as in the last 12 months. So if you were in large cap value asset classes and small cap value asset classes, and REITs, for example, real estate investment trusts, all of those indexes really did quite well and tempered the negative impact of perhaps the rest of your portfolio, so that really, if you had a well-diversified portfolio over the last 12 months, you might be pretty close to delta even if you were properly diversified. And the saying is that it's always darkest before the dawn applies to financial markets as well. It was a mistake for investors to believe even 1 or 2 years ago that somehow this time it's different. We've got to jump into the NASDAQ. Well, the law of economics probably has not changed. But just as in an environment where profits are going up and conditions are good, people tend to overstate how good it is. And then they make a similar mistake to believe that when we're in an environment where people are overstating how bad the situation is, both for the economy and the stock market. That's kind of the doom and gloomers of the last 2 or 3 months. Paul, for one, believes that most of the bad news is behind us. I think that's a good sign when Paul believes that, because Paul's a pretty bright guy and knows a lot about these things. And the Federal Reserve, of course, has abruptly reversed its course of tightening and is providing lower interest rates and increased liquidity, of course, to the financial system. And this strongly suggests that help is on the way for both the economy and the stock markets, a big plus for investors. Inflation, with the exception of perhaps retail prices of oil and oil products, is still very low. Global interest rates are continuing to fall. Our interest rates continue to fall. And tax rates apparently are about to fall. And interestingly enough, institutional and mutual fund cash positions are at their highest level in about 2 years. And there will eventually be pressure to put this cash back to work in the stock market. So most stock market prices today are at least more reasonably valued, less risky than they were even 2 or 3 months ago, if earning prospects are deemed to be favorable. To be sure, sharp stock market declines can be disturbing. They're extremely painful. However, even though markets go down, they don't stay down for the long term, and that's the important lesson to remember. Just as it would have been a mistake to sell stocks during the global meltdown of 1998, you've probably already forgotten about that, when we had hedge funds going broke, when we had things in international financial ruin, the stock markets were coming to an end, stock prices were down 25 to 40%. In that period of time, it would have been a clear mistake to sell stocks then, as well as a clear mistake, I think, to sell stocks now. Let's put the current temporary decline behind us, and not focus on the direction of the next 1,000 Dow points or the next 200 NASDAQ points or 500. Let's think long term. Back in 1974, before most of us had $1 invested in stocks, most of us didn't have stocks back in 1974, Roger G. Ibbotson and Rex Singfield, both authors of the annually published Stocks, Bonds, Bills, and Inflation Forecast, they suggested that the Dow Jones would reach 10,000 in November of 1999. In fact, that level was reached in March of 1999. They assumed compounded interest rates of some 13% annually. Their annual 2000 yearbook estimates that the Dow Jones Index will reach 100,000 by year-end 2025. And that should provide some optimism for folks who are even newly retired, as most people often live 20 to 30 years in retirement. Now, Rex Singfield and Roger G. Ibbotson, for people who know something about the financial markets, know that these people are not lightweights. These people are Nobel laureates and have done some of the seminal studies on modern portfolio theory. even if the Dow only appreciates at the rate of 5% compounded for the next many years. The Dow would reach 35,000 by the year 2025. You know, there's always good reasons not to buy stocks, particularly in times of economic, political, and market stress. I guess that's a time we're in right now, as a matter of fact. It would certainly not have felt right to buy stocks on the day of President Kennedy's assassination, for instance. But Paul suggests that while all of us remember the shocking event, 1 year later, the Dow Jones was 25% higher. 2 years later, it was 33% higher. And who would have had the sanity, perhaps, to begin buying stocks during the Watergate scandal? But if you had begun to buy stocks during this period, from Vice President Agnew's resignation until President Nixon left office 10 months later, your stock portfolio would have appreciated over 50%. Isn't that interesting? By the end of 1976. Certainly nobody would have faulted the investor who sold stocks when President Bush gave Saddam his ultimatum. After all, it was obvious to most that war was imminent. Who would have predicted that stock prices would be 25% higher just 6 weeks later? Finally, who could have criticized an investor who sold stocks in the midst of that global panic that I suggested and referred to back in 1998? After all, major magazines like Money Magazine, Newsweek, had huge titles, had huge pictures saying the crash of 98. Well, they put those pictures in their magazines right at the bottom of the stock market. And as suggested earlier, and as I truly believe, it's always darkest just before the dawn. Diversification works when you need it most. So keep the faith, stay the course, don't dump those stocks. I'll get angry with you because you are a long-term stock market investor. So there you have it, David, a little bit of homespun reality about the U.S. stock markets. And at least the last few days, maybe there's a little bit of a silver lining. Maybe the clouds, those dark clouds, have parted just a bit.
All right. Well, our guest this morning, Dave Sinnoh. He's president and CEO, Strategic Capital Bank and Trust. He is here monthly on a Friday. We talk about the economy, about personal finance. And so if you have questions, anything that he's discussed or anything else that has to do with investing and money management, all you have to do is give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so it won't cost you anything, but would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455. I was really interested to learn, I guess maybe this was a couple of months ago, and I thought this was an important indicator of the way people were feeling, that one business that had taken a big hit were the online brokers, and that people were flooding back to traditional brokers where they go in and they have a person that can help them make their decisions. So obviously a lot of people did not have the same level of confidence in their own ability to pick stocks.
That's because they were lucky and not good. And if you'll remember a year and a half or 2 years ago when the NASDAQ was just going through the ceiling, if you'll remember the chat rooms that just sprung up on the internet and everyone was an expert on this stock and this .com company, it was really quite interesting to watch. And you're absolutely right. Part of the unemployment fallout in this country is in the financial services industry, where online brokerage firms that were doing literally hundreds of millions of shares of business have really slowed down, have really cut back. And it does suggest that people should align themselves with a financial advisor who at least can hold their hand. No one has all the answers, but at least can hold their hand.
Hmm. Well, again, the telephone lines here are open. You want to give us a call and talk with our guest, David Sinnoh, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And actually, I'm going to have to talk right in the air to my guy here, Brian Wagner. I know it says that there's a caller up on the screen, but on my panel over here on this side, I got nothing. So I think maybe we need to push a couple of buttons, and we'll get everybody lined up, and we'll be all square.
David, I did have two letters that came to my attention. They were actually directed to my office, and they both covered the same point, and they were from listeners in our audience who said, you know, I got the double whammy last year, and that is that I lost money in my mutual funds, and at the end of the year, I got this statement from my mutual fund company saying that I owed all of this tax based upon my ordinary dividends and my capital gain dividend distributions. How is that possible that my market value went from $1 to 85 cents, and then I'm getting a tax bill on top of it. Well, remember in stock mutual funds, first of all, that mutual funds are consist of stocks, and believe it or not, some of those stocks actually declare dividends. So those dividends are actually passed on to you in the form of ordinary dividends. And whether you own the stock individually or own it inside a mutual fund, fair is fair, and you're going to be taxed on ordinary dividends. That isn't really what people were complaining about. They said, well, what is this capital gain dividend business? How does that work? And I lost money. How in the world could I have a capital gain? Well, early in the year 2000, many mutual funds who did have gains from 1999 decided to sell those individual stock positions, some of those positions, and reap the gain inside the mutual fund. And as a mutual fund, then, they have to pass that gain on to the shareholder in the form of dividends or additional shares. Then the next thing that happened, of course, is that the rest of their positions declined in value. So as a result, you're not only having to pay a capital gains distribution on some stock that got sold, the stocks that remained actually went down in value, having the impact that your total portfolio actually went negative from the year before. That's a very unhappy circumstance. It was highly unusual last year, and it happened to almost everyone, and it took almost everyone, including ourselves with respect to a couple of our own funds, totally by surprise, because it's really quite unusual to have that happen. Probably the best way to avoid that is to call your mutual fund company early in December and ask them for an estimate of the capital gains distributions that you would incur in that mutual fund. So I hope that answers the question, because it was interesting. It was two disparate letters that were really covering the same comments.
Okay. We do have a caller here ready to go, and others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Peoria, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Sinnel.
Good morning, sir.
Two topics. 1974, I bought Silco stock at $13. 2 years ago, they called all the stocks in, and I got $83,000.
You got $83,000.
Right.
And what was your original investment?
$1,300.
Well, I'm I've got my calculator here, so I'm going to take $1,300 and I'm going to put that in as the present value. I'm going to put $83,000 in as the future value, and I'm going to put 26 years in as the period that you held that, and I'm going to figure out your compounded rate of return. At least my Hewlett-Packard is. I'm not that fast. But my Hewlett-Packard right now says running. That's a 17.34% annualized compounded rate of return. What a phenomenal, phenomenal return. And I guess the lesson is to hang on through thick and thin.
Right. Now, the second topic, I get a call almost every day, sometimes twice a day. Somebody wants to sell me some stock in natural gas and oil. And I don't know where they got my name or my telephone number.
Well, I don't know that either. You're obviously on some type of master list, and my condolences, because I think a lot of folks get those kinds of calls. And obviously, anyone who is pitching an investment over the phone, that would probably be the last investment that I would ever buy over the phone. Occasionally, if something interests me, I said, send me a prospectus.
I do.
And I'm sure you do. And the minute someone says, no, this is only available today, this is hot today, it's time to hang up the telephone.
That's what I do.
And that's what you do. Well, I know that you're a savvy securities investor. I know you're a savvy real estate investor. My biggest problem is I'm not a relative of yours. I can see that, because I probably could learn a lot from your savvy investing. Well, what do you think of this market?
I finance some of the homes that my boys buy.
That's very laudable. What do you think about this market?
I think it stinks.
Yeah. And what do you think about the economy? Are we in a recession, going into a recession, or are we going to have a soft landing? What do you think?
Well, I think we're going to have a hard landing.
Okay.
We export less than we import.
Yes. That's a big problem, because that has an impact on our gross domestic product. That's for sure. And I'm going to come back to that formula for our audience in just a few minutes. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line 1 for somebody here locally. There's Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a foolish question, but what are the penalties for withdrawing early from an IRA account? Can you take that hit on just a portion of the IRA fund, or do you have to take the hit on the whole fund? And I don't know if that's a good question.
That's a great question. Bottom line is that if you are under age 59 and a half and you withdraw all or some of your money from your self-directed IRA, you have two tax implications. The first tax implication will be a penalty. Let's say you had $20,000 in an IRA and you decided that you needed $10,000. If you took $10,000 out of your IRA before you can get that $10,000, your plan sponsor is going to withhold 10% as an IRS penalty and send the Internal Revenue Service immediately $1,000. No way around that. So then you would receive $9,000 directly from your plan sponsor. In addition, come the next April 15th, you're going to have to report the entire $10,000 as an ordinary income tax event.
Right.
And you'll be paying that at your highest marginal rate. You won't be paying income tax on your entire IRA, just the amount that you take out early.
So the penalty doesn't cover the whole amount, just the amount withdrawn.
That's correct. Now, there are some exceptions which have to do with the kind of IRA you have. If, for example, you have a Roth IRA and you are using the money for a down payment on a first-time home, or in certain cases of disability and medical payments, but they're complicated rules and you really would need to work with an accountant to make sure that you comply to avoid the penalty. In any event, typically, when you take money out, even if you could avoid a penalty, if you're doing this before age 59 and a half, you would still pay ordinary income tax on the amount that you take out, unless you are in a Roth IRA program.
Okay. Now, when you roll over money from, a corporate 401k into an IRA, does the same rule apply? Or if you wanted to withdraw money, would you roll the 401k over before taking any money out of
it? In other words, are you under 59 and a half?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. If you're under 59 and a half, it's a bad idea, but typically what you would do is you would have your corporate plan sponsor roll the entire amount directly to your self-directed IRA.
Right.
That would be step one. That is a tax-free event. There is
right.
no tax implication to that. The important thing is that when the money is transferred, it is either electronically transferred to your new plan sponsor, or in the alternative, if a check is going to be handed to you, the check needs to be made out to the new plan sponsor, FBO, for the benefit of your
right,
IRA.
Right. Otherwise,
there's a 20% withholding right out of the amount.
Ooh.
20% goes right to the government. So if you get a check out of your 401k for $100,000 payable to you, then 20% is going to go right to the government because they're worried that you're not going to pay your tax on time. So they're going to collect theirs up front.
Well, that makes sense.
Isn't that interesting? Now, when you are in your IRA, it's just, again, the rule, you're in a self-directed IRA rollover, and right. the same rules would apply as a traditional IRA.
Right. Okay. And then I just have a more general question, and I'll hang up. I'm curious about the stock market because I personally believe it's been overvalued since it went over 7,000 points. And the only reason I believe this is, I think growth is based upon capitalization and investment in actual profit-making ventures. And it seems that there's a lot of concentration in capital acquiring just other capital right now. And I just think that in and of itself makes the stock market really volatile, maybe not headed for a crash, but certainly, very vulnerable to major currency fluctuations or other crises. And so I'm just curious. I'm one of the people who wonders about the irrational exuberance of the market. There is a lot of growth and new ideas and new technologies, but I'm not really sure there's a profitable capitalization going on to increase potential earnings and growth. So if you'd just like to talk about that, I'll sit back and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's a great question. I think Alan Greenspan talked originally about irrational exuberance, and I think with the correction that took place in the stock market, some of that irrational exuberance has been ameliorated. You know, when we talk about the future prospects of earnings and dividend growth for companies, because after all, if a company is never going to make any money, ultimately you have to pay the price. They're going to go down in value, and you just can't continue to buoy up the price of a stock because more capital is chasing that particular company. Eventually, the company is going to have to show profits, which really means that we have to have an expanding economy. In other words, our gross domestic product needs to continue to expand. And when we look at gross domestic product, it's really made up of about four elements. Element number one, of course, is consumer spending. We've got to have consumers out there feeling good about our economy and spending. The second element of a gross domestic product, to see it moving forward, is investment by business. The third element is government spending. That's sort of the big unknown. And then something our gentleman from Peoria mentioned, what is the relationship between exports and imports? And for a long, long period of time, as you know, in terms of balance of payments, we're exporting a heck of a lot more than we're importing. So we're not selling as many goods abroad. Part of that's due to the international economies that a little bit of them have been in a funk lately too. So all of those elements are out there when we look at gross domestic product. And if we break those down point by point, about two-thirds of our gross domestic product is really based upon consumer spending. You've heard for a long time that's why consumers have to spend. Well, when we have unemployment moving up, last month it went from 4.2 to 4.3%, for example. When we have the largest drop in service jobs in 9.5 years last month, when we have the manufacturing sector continuing to lose jobs for the last 9 months, even though that seems to be slowing down, that doesn't make consumers very confident. And as a result, they spend less. So I'm very concerned myself, at least in the short run, that we're going to have a drop in consumer spending. Another reason that we may have a drop in consumer spending is something referred to as the wealth effect. I believe, with the exception of the last week, that in terms, if we looked back at the entire value of all the U.S. stock markets a year, year and a half ago, before the huge decline that has taken place, over this last year, I believe somewhere around $4 trillion of market value has been lost. Now, a lot of it is paper loss, but the bottom line is that the markets as a whole are worth about $4 trillion less than they used to be. And most economists argue that for every $1 trillion of market loss, consumers are going to spend less money, somewhere between $100 and $150 billion. So that could transfer today to less spending of somewhere between $500 and $600 billion. If you have less market value in your 401k, less in your other positions, well, maybe you're less likely to buy that new automobile. Maybe you're less likely to go out and spend money on consumer durables. So consumer spending is a big if right now in the economy. I'm going to come back to these other elements in a minute, but David, I see we do have listeners waiting.
Yes, we do. And we also have about, well, let me see, 5, 10, 50, about 20 minutes left in the program.
Good calculation.
And if you'd like to talk with our guest, Dave Sinnoh, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a person in Champaign, a person in Urbana. We'll go first to Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I always look forward to this show. Mr. Sinnoh, can you comment at all on the possibility that increased spending for heat and electricity, those sorts of utilities, has impacted consumer spending and that's had any effect on the economy?
That's a very good question. It's a tough question to answer. The statistics that I have seen on this really have more to do with the inflation issues. And that is that with the rise in commodity prices, the rise in gasoline prices, what has that done to inflation in the economy? And it's estimated that it's increased inflation in the economy somewhere between 0.2% and 0.3%. But unquestionably, in my gut, when I am paying $1.69 at the pump for regular unleaded gasoline, and I used to pay $1.10 or $1.20, it's a tax increase. It's as simple as that. I'm getting a tax increase. I'm spending more on something that I've got to have, that I've got to consume. So while some parts of the economy may be benefiting by this additional expense, other areas of the economy are certainly hurting, and it does have an impact on my overall consumer spending. So I think you're right. What's Mr. Greenspan and what's the Fed doing about this? Trying to reduce interest rates, trying to give us a tax cut to ameliorate this impact and to further spur consumer spending. So think about all of those people who are driving semi-trucks and what that's costing now in terms of fuel and how that essentially gets distributed through the economy and what impact that has on other consumer goods. It does have some. Now, on the positive side, when you actually look at the raw price of commodities, for example, 1 year ago, or the 12-month high on oil was $37.50 a barrel. Thursday, it closed at about $27.82. So that's 10 over 37. So that's about, what, about a 22% decline in the raw price of commodities. But it is certainly not translated, probably because of distributorship problems and other kinds of problems that we have internally in this country. It hasn't been reflected in lower prices, certainly for us. So yes, I think at least psychologically, it additionally has some impact. So isn't it interesting how all of these events have sort of coalesced at the same time? A declining stock market, rising prices at the gas tank, uncertainty abroad. Lots and lots of issues have coalesced to dampen consumer confidence. And we need stronger consumer confidence. We need to have it bottom out and start moving up in order to ensure that we're not going to have some type of major recession. On the positive side, it seems as though the most recent statistics show that it has bottomed up and it has moved up very, very slightly.
Next caller is Urbana, line two.
Hi. My situation is I'm 39 years old. I've worked 3 years in a public school system, retirement system, and that has set, I had a child, and that has set for 5 years, and now it will not, my contributions will not gain interest. I need to take them out and roll them over into something, and it's only about $8,500. And that's about all the sum of my retirement anywhere. So that's in a teacher's retirement fund in Missouri. Where would you suggest somebody that's, you know, that old with that kind of work history, which isn't too much, should put that money, roll that over?
Well, you would roll that over into a tax-deferred program, probably a self-directed IRA program. And I have said many times in the past, at age 39, you need to save this money for retirement. You have a very long life expectancy at 839 today. You're probably at least going to live into the 80s, so you have time on your side, and obviously you're not retiring tomorrow. So bottom line is rolling that money into a self-directed IRA program, and then I believe that you should probably be in equities, in stock mutual funds. I think an appropriate place to do this, for example, would be at the Vanguard family of mutual funds. I've said before that Vanguard has a wonderful website, www.vanguard.com. I'm not an owner in Vanguard. It's a private company. But for retail folks and with smaller amounts of money, they basically have a very similar philosophy to my philosophy, and that is that you can purchase broad asset classes of stocks through Vanguard, and you can build your own diversification. So with $8,500, for example, you might build four or five different stock mutual funds at Vanguard, mostly index funds. Those are the kinds of funds that I would recommend. And you can go to their website and you can read about index investing from them. It's a very inexpensive way to invest, and that would be my suggestion. You can even fill out the IRA application. You can download it, print it out, and do all of the things necessary to set up a self-directed IRA through Vanguard or, frankly, through any of the major mutual fund companies for that matter. So that's what I would suggest. As an alternative, you might consider visiting with a financial advisor. 39, you really need to start doing some serious planning unless someone else is going to take care of your retirement. And there are a number of very good financial planners, advisors, and brokers in the surrounding area.
Okay, so four or five different index funds with Vanguard, or the alternative, meet with a planner here.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then the second question, I have a four-and-a-half-year-old, and I'm trying to save a little bit for her college education. And one of the local banks, the financial advisors had mentioned, had recommended Washington Mutual or Euro-Pacific Growth Funds. Do you think they're good for a four-and-a-half-year-old?
Well, I think you're on the right track. I really don't want to get hung up in the specific fund that's being recommended. I think, though, for a 4.5-year-old, again, you're saving for at least the next 14 years. Clearly, if you are going to be placing money aside for this child, it should be in stocks and stock mutual funds, because that really has the best likelihood of keeping up with inflation. At the same time, when you do accumulate a certain amount of money, you want to take a look at some of the state programs like College Illinois, for example, where you can buy a semester of college today and you hold that semester cost constant, even though the inflationary impact is just huge over the next 14 years. So what I recommend is a combination of things, taking advantage of a College Illinois program, and then in addition, you still got to pay for housing, you got to pay for all those other things that a college student is going to be facing, and the way you would do that is through a stock mutual fund investment.
Ah, because I had mentioned that College Illinois to the planner, and they said it was better just to be in stocks, that you would come out better than to invest in that program.
I'm not certain of that. I think what you really want to do is to be able to do both.
Both, okay.
Because I think under College Illinois, the last time I looked at it, I think that imputed interest rate of return was somewhere between 6 and 7% annualized, and then those dollars, when they come out, at least under current law, would be taxed at the child's rate, which basically will be zero, and it may well be, because there is legislation pending federally that may actually do away with all of the income tax impact on that money for a child. That's going to be a tough return to beat, but at the same time, you want to have exposure to equities.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you. To another person here. This is also Urbana. It's line three. Hello.
Hi. I just have a simple question. A couple of years ago, I bought a house, and now I'd like to finance it. I'm just wondering, is that a good time for me to do it right now, or shall I wait another couple of months?
No, I think you have a window of opportunity right now. Now, when we talk about refinancing a home, remember that those interest rates bounce around quite a bit on any given day. So they may be on a 15-year mortgage today, 6 5/8. They may be 6.5 tomorrow. They may be 6 3/4 the next day. Mm-hmm. So these interest rates are bouncing around, but they are very, very competitive at the moment. And I don't think you should take the chance of waiting. There is certainly no guarantee in my mind that mortgage rates are going to go much lower than they are today, even if the Federal Reserve reduces interest rates another 0.5% at their May Federal Reserve meeting. And in fact, often when the Fed actually reduces short-term interest rates, mortgage rates don't necessarily follow, and sometimes they even bounce higher. What you really want to do is work with a mortgage company that, when you lock in, provides you the opportunity that if mortgage rates move down further, that you can either take advantage of the lower rate before the close, or alternatively, they will refinance you again at that lower rate for literally no money, or just perhaps just an application fee. Mm-hmm. So that if rates move down further, you're really getting the further benefit of that rate decrease.
Okay. Thank you very much.
But don't wait.
Okay, all right.
Thanks. Thank you. To line one next. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hi, I had a question about the College Illinois program. I don't know if you've addressed this or not, but I read somewhere that, say, if you took out $10,000 worth of college tuition, and by the time your child is ready to go to school, that tuition would be worth $50,000, the IRS would tax you at a $40,000 profit. Is this true?
Not exactly. Not exactly. And these rules are in flux, and they're going to probably change 25 times between now and when your child is in college. Basically, the way this works today in most states is that when you start taking money out, the gain is taxed at your child's rate. And presumably, your child is going to be a lower income tax bracket than you are. You've got to make a pretty good sum of money to be above a 15% income tax rate today. Follow that?
Uh-huh.
You also get the advantage of the deferral. You're not being taxed on that money every year. So if that money were in a simple savings account, in a simple stock account, you'd be paying tax on the dividends or the income each year. And as I just mentioned, there is pending legislation. There's a lot of talk that this type of gain, so long as it is being utilized for tuition and fees for college, shouldn't be taxed at all. So I don't think you want to not go ahead with the program because of the uncertain tax implications. There are reasonable tax implications today, and they may even get better tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
All right. And another Champaign person. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I had a question about cost basis information.
Yes.
I had some money that was in mutual funds that I put in my parents' names for a few years. And I recently transferred it back into my name. And now the mutual fund companies want to know what cost basis information I should give them.
So essentially, did you loan this money to them or did you actually gift this money? Was it in their name and in their Social Security number?
Yes.
So you actually made a gift of funds and you placed money, your money, into their name. Is that fair?
Yes.
And you purchased mutual funds.
Yes.
All right. So that's step number one. So that mutual fund had a cost basis at the time that it was transferred back to you.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
Now, typically, if I remember my rules right, and if these aren't correct, I hope an accountant's listening and call in and correct me,
okay,
that when you gift between family members, your basis is the lower of the current basis of that security or the fair market value, whichever is less. Let me give you an example. Let's say that at the time that you are transferring it back from your parents back to you, mm-hmm, the mutual fund has a fair market value of $10,000. Say that that's if you liquidated it on that day, you would have gotten $10,000. But the cost basis of that fund was $8,000. All right?
Okay.
So there was a $2,000 capital gain. Hadn't been paid yet, but there was $2,000 of potential capital gain. Your basis under the formula would be the lower of the market value or their cost basis. So in that particular case, your basis would be $8,000. How do you determine what the basis is?
Yes.
Well, here's how you do that. And this is another question that was asked in that letter that was sent to me, and I should address this as well. Go back and see exactly how many dollars you poured into the fund or funds. Let's just take one mutual fund. Let's say you bought one mutual fund.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and take a look at your checkbook and see exactly how many dollars you put into that fund.
Before I gifted it to my parents.
That's step number one.
Okay.
And step number two, you've got to go back and look at all of the dividends that taxes were paid on in that fund.
Okay.
So you got to go back to your tax returns and your parents' tax returns to see all of the dividends, capital gains dividends and ordinary dividends that you had to report on a 1040. You take all of those dividend amounts, you add that back to the actual cash that you used to purchase these funds, and that total will give you your tax basis.
Okay. A second related question. They say that if I do not provide them with a cost basis, that's fine.
Right.
What happens if I don't?
Well, here's how a mutual fund company generally works. Some mutual fund companies actually provide you with a cost basis, typically what's called an average cost basis, because you're buying securities or continuing to buy them, so you're always averaging in, so they figure out an average cost basis for you. When you sell a mutual fund or transfer a mutual fund, then it generates a particular kind of tax reporting statement. The mutual fund company generates something called a 1099-B,
right,
which is a statement of all the transactions that you're involved in terms of sales. That's all they have to report to IRS. They don't have to report your basis. So if you sold $10,000 of a mutual fund, you're going to get a transaction report from them before, what, January 31st of next year, that says that you are one of those Americans who sold and we're reporting a sale of $10,000 on this mutual fund and it's reported on a 1099-B. The government gets it, you get it. Now it is your responsibility on Schedule D, which is the capital gain schedule of your tax return, to fill that out showing the cost basis of that asset and whether there is a gain or a loss and whether it's a long-term gain or a short-term gain or loss, for example.
Okay, so I can't just forget this.
Oh, no, 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 no. Internal Revenue Service will not let you forget this.
Okay.
So they won't do that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have a couple of minutes left. If somebody's got a question, they have to dial right now, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, and we can get you in before the end of the show.
David, obviously, as Alan Greenspan continues to reduce interest rates on the short end, Treasury rates, certificate of deposit rates, money market rates continue to fall. And, of course, for long-term fixed income investors, that doesn't make them extraordinarily happy. So isn't it interesting? For example, let's just take a three-month Treasury bill. A year ago, if you were in three-month Treasury bills, your total return would somewhere be about 5.6%. Today, about 3.7%. That is a huge drop. So as people have their certificates of deposit maturing, in the old days, some of those were 6 and 7% CDs. In the new days, they're a lot less.
We'll get at least one more person here in Hume on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was just wondering what his thoughts were on medical savings accounts for self-employed.
I really don't have an opinion. It's a good question. I've never used them myself. I know some of our clients use them. And as long as you can keep the administrative costs low, the clients who have used them that we have done very well with them thus far. And the real issue is the administrative costs. And if you can keep the administrative costs low, they certainly are something worthwhile.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Then, well, we'll try one more here. Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hi, I just had a quick question about U.S. savings bonds. Is that worth it anymore as far as the return you get if you're saving for your kids' college?
It's a good question. I don't know the current rate when you go in and buy a U.S. savings bond. You certainly would want to be somewhere in the 5, 6 to 7% rate to make it worthwhile as opposed to, for example, going into something like a College Illinois. Mm-hmm. I still think these prepaid college programs are a better place than U.S. savings bonds. Nothing wrong with U.S. savings bonds,
but I
think they're a better place.
I meant like in addition to College Illinois.
Mm-hmm. I think in addition to College Illinois, because that really is on the fixed income side, I'd rather see you on the stock mutual fund side, on the equity side.
Okay.
Because savings bonds are still additional fixed income.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. There we'll leave it with the promise that Dave will be back again next month. Thank you.
Thank you. It's always fun.
David Sinnoh, President, CEO, Strategic Capital Bank and Trust Company. Also a reminder that another source of investing information is a program called Sound Money. We have it Saturday mornings at 10 here on AM 580. And within that program, there are opportunities to call and ask questions. So if you have not listened to that show, you might want to check it out.